Okay, if everyone is ready, we'd like to get started. Thank you all for coming. I am Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, and I am, in addition to presenting, I'm going to also moderate. I don't know how you present and moderate simultaneously, but at least I'm going to make the announcements at the outset of today's class. So thank you to the Harry H. Baron Trust and Rabbi Zev Baron for the continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons. This is the final Torah for Tycoons class for this season, as we conclude T for T's 13th year, Bar Mitzvah year, and the class will resume in September. And I know some of you really want us to do this in July and August, so if you have people who want to do it, we'll be happy to do it. But otherwise, we're going to continue in September. Throughout the past 12 seasons, the Kol has brought Torah perspectives on business and personal ethics to well over 500 people through this program. If you've missed past Torah for Tycoons classes, or any other classes for that matter, you can get the recordings at the Kol's website, and that's www.denverkolel.org. You can also find the latest info on Kol programming and archived classes on many topics on our website. And with that, I'd like to introduce today's presenters. To my right is Ari Hoffman, a counselor, MALPC, and yours truly, Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, senior educator for the Denver Community Kollel. And with that, I will ask Mr. Hoffman to begin his presentation.
Thank you, Rabbi Fleischer.
Great job. Excellent welcome, really.
I can moonlight doing this, right? Okay.
I want to thank the Kollel and Rabbi Fleischer for inviting me to participate in this. This is my first time attending, and it looks fun. Maybe we should do it more often. I want to start with telling you a little bit about who I am and why I'm talking to you. Rabbi Noach Orlowick, he's an author and goes around the world speaking on the topic of parenting, says the following three tips about speaking. He says, number one, you should care about your audience. Number two, you should care about your topic. Number three, and by far least important, you should know something about what you're talking about. My hope in speaking to you today is that both from what I have to offer and from what Rabbi Fleischer has to offer is that you will be able to go out and have maybe a different relationship with your parents and even a different relationship with your children, even in the smallest level. That's my hope for now. And so that's what I care about. Rabbi Abraham Tversky was once asked how he was able to write so many books. I don't know, he's written about 20-some books. And he answered that, really, I wrote one book about self-esteem, and then I wrote the same book 20-some times over. So the theme of the work that most of the work that I do as a psychotherapist is helping people be present and deal with trauma triggers. That's something I'm fascinated by. I'm fascinated by trauma. I'm fascinated how our mind and our bodies respond to trauma. And so that's going to be kind of the theme of what I'm going to talk about today. Parents keep me in business. I just want you to think about that for a minute because it's completely true. Now, I also know that it is quite likely that I will be keeping some other therapists in business for my own children. And it's important that you recognize that I'm sitting here not as a perfect child by far. I'm glad my parents are not here. Nor as a perfect parent, but as a person who just understands that relationship. Let's talk a little bit about big T and little T trauma. Big T trauma is the stuff you read about in the newspapers. War, plane crashes, car accidents, violence, that sort of thing. Little T trauma, conversely, can actually take up a similar space in our brains and our bodies, but it doesn't have the same excitement, I guess, as what you read about in the newspaper. Little T trauma, one of my examples of little T trauma is when I was in seventh grade, I had a teacher, eighth grade actually, I had a teacher tell me, Ari, sometimes I feel like I'm teaching a special ed class because of you. Now, that didn't make the newspaper, but that memory stayed with me for many, many years, and the hurt stayed with me also for many years. Gratefully, I've told the story so many times now, I think it's like it's kind of gone now. It doesn't bother me anymore. But it stayed with me for a long time. Now, trauma gets coded in our minds and in our bodies in a different way than other memories. Traumatic memories get coded often more as experiential memories versus narrative memories. A narrative memory is, I can tell you, if I can remember, I can tell you what I had for supper last night. I had for supper last night soup. I had minestrone soup, okay? And I could tell you about it, but I'm not going back there and experiencing it. An experiential memory is where, for whatever reason, when this memory comes up, I'm actually back there. I'm truly, literally, in some way, my mind is back as if I was back in the middle of that trauma. We're going to talk about a lot of different types of experiences in a very short amount of time. And I'd like us to just imagine a bell curve, something that I would assume most of us are familiar with, just a standard bell curve with the top right in the middle. Most of us, I'm being a little bit liberal here, I guess, but I'm going to propose that most of us had experiences with our parents, that our parents basically wanted the best for us, tried their hardest for us, and probably messed up a number of times, but in general, the intention was pretty decent, that they wanted us to grow up and be contributing members of society, have healthy relationships, etc. Okay? So that's it. This part of the bell curve, as it goes down, the minority on both sides, on this side, the minority had absolute perfect parents. And just like if you could all raise your hands and tell me who of you had the absolute perfect parents. Okay, very good. So we're doing well. Statistics maintained. You did, okay.
No, how about those of us who aren't perfect parents?
Oh, very good. Right here. Very good. And then, sadly, on the other side, the other part of the other minority is those parents who were significantly abusive. And we're looking for the adjective here, but we'll just call it abusive. And these are parents who emotionally, physically, or sexually made their children feel totally unsafe, or majority unsafe. Now, in those situations, that's the theme. I don't feel safe. For most of the rest of us, there were situations where maybe we felt insulted, maybe we felt embarrassed, maybe we felt put down, maybe we felt not respected. But there's a significant difference between this majority of us in the bell curve versus this small section where we feel truly unsafe, like our survival is at stake. Let's talk a little bit about how trauma triggers present themselves. And this stuff is like is fascinating, amazing, and I really enjoy reading about this. If you have any interest in this, in the topic, I can recommend a number of books. But let's talk about the war veteran in King Soopers. I want you to imagine a veteran comes back from fighting in Iraq, and he goes to King Soopers. Now, a number of us have probably been to the Middle East, to Israel. Just imagine some of the high-density, low-income areas of Israel, stacked up apartments, and what is it about the entryways to Israeli apartments that they're so poorly lit? I don't really get that. Although a lot of the hallways, they don't really have lights. So just imagine Middle Eastern area. They're in Iraq and similar apartments. All the different entryway and going around corners, it's all poorly lit. And around each corner is another potential threat, is another potential death. That's scary. Okay. But the body adapts and learns to survive. So this gentleman spends, I don't know, 3-6 months in Iraq and is spending this time clearing out these apartments. And then he comes back. He's back in Denver. And he's going to go to King Soopers for a 20-minute shopping trip. Now, I would assume that you and I don't get triggered very much when you go to King Soopers. Maybe when I take my kids to King Soopers and they beg for candy, that triggers me a little bit. But most of us don't get triggered. This gentleman, every time he goes around another aisle, which is a blind corner, his mind tells him there might be a bomb or a gun around this corner. So you can imagine that after 20 minutes, this gentleman is completely wrecked. That's a trauma trigger. Another one. I was in a car accident last September, September 2016. I was hit by a cement truck, which hit a Prius, which hit me. We all walked away. Everybody was fine. I can still see that cement truck in my rearview mirror. I can still see him coming. And I still feel it, especially when I'm on the highway. And now with the influx of everybody into Denver, now the highway, it just happens regularly. You're on the highway and then stop, right? And there's still traffic coming up behind you. Every time I'm there, I feel that. I can feel it right here, just to the left of my solar plexus. I feel that fear. I'm back there seeing that same cement truck. Now, intellectually, I can tell myself, well, no, you know, you're fine now. Everything's okay. But no, part of my body is back where the trauma was. One final example is I was reading a book about a Holocaust survivor, a child survivor of the Holocaust, who had to hide in a barrel somewhere, wherever he was being hidden, somewhere, I don't know, near Germany or Poland. He went back there as an older man, probably in his 70s. And he went back there and he started crying. And he said, "I'm still there. I'm still in the barrel." He could feel himself still in the barrel after all these decades later. This is how trauma gets coded in our minds and our bodies, the experiential memory that we feel like we're back there. Any sense can trigger these memories. And so if we imagine all the senses that come up with, you know, with our parents, I'm eating the same food, I hear my parents' voices, touch, sight, anything, those they can all trigger trauma. So I want to talk to you about one of the most amazing one-liners for relationships, and that's from the Menachem Mendel Morgenstern of Kutz, also known as the Kutzker. And he said this following thing, and I need your attention here because this is very important. So open your minds and open your hearts. He says like this: "If I am I because you are you, and you are you because I am I, then I am not I, and you are not you. However, if I am I because I am I, and you are you because you are you, then I am I and you are you." Raise your hand if you're a little confused. It probably took me 5-6 times to really understand this. So I'm going to explain it. If I am I because you are you, and you are you because I am I, meaning if my existence is dependent on yours, and your existence is dependent on mine, then basic math says we cancel each other out. We don't exist. However, if I am I because I am I and my existence is intrinsic, and you are you because you are you and your existence is intrinsic, then you and I can meet and have a relationship. Because we're two individual people. Fascinating, very deep and important idea that was taught to me by one of my mentors, a guy by the name of Ryan Kennedy, like this. Children grow up. As children, we believe on some level that our parents are perfect. There's very interesting discussion from some Jewish professionals, actually, about how our image of our parents is actually becomes our image of God, and how our relationship with our parents becomes a relationship with God. It's a different conversation, but a fascinating idea all the same. We grow up believing that our parents are perfect. And here's an important thing. If my father is perfect and my father hurt me, then I must be faulty. There must be something wrong with me. And that's damaging. As we get older, we need to start to... the healthy process of getting older is when we start to realize not only am I not perfect, but also my parents are not perfect. And if I am not perfect and my parents are not perfect, maybe we can separate that tight connection of my parents' perfection and therefore my imperfection. We can move those away, and then maybe we can meet as two people together, two imperfect people. So that's one way to get to this individuated and more healthy relationship with parents. Another way to get to that is mindfulness. This is a big buzzword. Everybody's talking about it. Nobody really knows what it means. I'm going to tell you very briefly what it means. It means being present and being able to feel. Now, I happen to be a big fan of body mindfulness. So I'm really interested in what is my body telling me. I happen to be a stress eater. You don't have to raise your hand, but maybe some of you can identify, maybe not, I don't know, whatever. I am a stress eater. When I feel stressed or anxious, I like to eat. You know why? Because I don't like that feeling of being stressed and anxious. And when I eat, it takes that feeling away. Now, body mindfulness would suggest, and something that I'm working on, would suggest maybe just stop and be with that feeling for a moment. Maybe pay attention to the difference between what it feels like to be anxious and what it feels like to be hungry. Pay attention to what you feel like when you're with your parents. Pay attention to what comes up in your body. The body, I put here, the body keeps the score. It's actually the title of a book by a gentleman by the name of Bessel van der Kolk, one of the foremost trauma experts in the country, if not the world. Our whole body will give us messages about what we're feeling. And so if we can take the time to actually pay attention to what our body is telling us, this will give us some clues about how we're responding. And if I can take a minute and just sit with an experience before I react. So let's say that, you know, corn chips and salsa for me is a reactive measure. Maybe I'm going to take a step back, and before I hit the corn chips and salsa, maybe a good IPA, possibly, I'm going to just sit with the feeling and just spend some time. What is my body telling me right now? Maybe my body's feeling anxious for a good reason. Okay. Everybody is coming from somewhere. This was something that was taught to me by Rabbi Yeshua Gutman, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. He was my 11th grade Rebbe in Yeshiva. And I will always remember, he said, always remember, everybody is coming from somewhere. In this process of individuation, when I can be me intrinsically and recognize that my parents is my parents intrinsically and also recognize my parents' imperfection, then I can take a step back and see, as harsh as my parent might have been to me or might be to me continually, where's my parent coming from? Geographically, generationally, relationally. What was my father and my mother, what were their parents like? And so to be able to take a step back and look at it in context, that gives me a little, like a little, I have, like, rachmanis, I have some, I feel bad a little bit. Like there was a lot there that, you know, that maybe our parents had to go through. And so recognizing everybody comes from somewhere. Finally, guilt versus I'm okay. I might feel guilty about not doing the things that my parents want me to do, right? My father or mother comes, spend some time with me. Why are you so busy all the time? You never hang out with me. What's the problem? It makes us think about Cat Stevens and Cats in the Cradle. One of my favorite songs. If I can take a step back and recognize that in most ways, the decisions that I make, if I make a decision intentionally and in consideration of other people, to recognize that that decision, I'm okay, then that helps maybe mitigate some of the guilt. Because guilt will often motivate, not always, but often motivate us to do something maybe we don't want to do. Yeah, I feel guilty, so I'm going to go do something that might hurt me, might be damaging to my relationship. But if I can take a step back and say, you know, I've made a decision about how I want to do things, and I'm okay in that decision, that will help mitigate some of the guilt. In honoring our parents, I believe that Rabbi Fleischer is going to touch on this a little bit. As we individuate and recognize, again, that we are coming together intrinsically, with intrinsic existence, and we've separated from that image of our perfect parents. And by doing that, we become more present when we experience those, you know, big T or little T trauma triggers with our parents. We can then choose how we want to engage with our parents. And just because I've done all this work on myself, and just because maybe I've gotten to a point where I forgive my father and my mother, doesn't mean I'm going to put myself in the same situation to get hurt again. This is a very important concept in both psychology and halacha, spanning many different dimensions of life. I don't have to intentionally put myself into a situation where I'm going to get hurt again just because I forgave you. Pick your flavor. Any way you want. Not any way you want necessarily, but come together with your parent and see, how does my parent want to engage with me, and then how do I want to engage with my parent? And then create that bridge. It doesn't have to be fully separate. And again, I am talking about the 90-90, 90% of the people, 90% of the time in that bell curve, not as much about the severe abuse. In situations like that, it could be that just because I forgive you, or maybe I don't forgive you at all, I just don't want to get hurt. Maybe saying I don't want to get hurt means I don't, means a complete cutoff, and maybe that's okay. But there are these opportunities to choose how I want to connect with my parents. And most of all, if you don't take anything away from this, except this last thing, I will feel like I've accomplished something here, which is be gentle to yourself. Be gentle to yourself. Be gentle to yourself. Don't get yourself into a situation where you're hurting. And if you do, figure out a way to mitigate it. Remember that you being a healthy human being, physically and emotionally healthy, is going to make all of your relationships better. It's going to make you a better human being. Connects a little bit to that classic metaphor of when we're in the airplane and the oxygen, right, they do the safety thing, right? Put on your mask before you help others. Because if you can't breathe, you're going to die. So breathe and then help other people. That will facilitate you being able to be that individuated, present person in relationship with your parents and everybody else. And that presence will help mitigate that experiential that experiential trauma memory. All that stuff comes back, but you've done this work a little bit on mindfulness, a little bit on being present, a little bit on being gentle, mourning your own parents' perfection, and you can take that and still push through and come back and engage in a real way. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ari. And thank you very much. And so I guess we will move right now straight to the Torah side of this presentation. And I guess as questions arise, as we'll try to meld together Ari's presentation with what I'm going to present. So we'll take those questions as we move along, and I'm sure Ari will have what to comment on what I'm going to be saying as well. If you're looking at your paper over here, you may be taken aback by the large number of sources I put together over here. It's a wee bit more than usual. A lot of them are just details that we really need to be aware of as we engage in this discussion. One of the Ten Commandments that were given at Sinai is honor your father and mother. Okay, so that your days will be lengthened. So not only is it a mitzvah in the Torah, but it made it into the Ten Commandments, which in of itself ought to show us the importance associated with that commandment. Now that is the mitzvah of the commandment to honor a parent. There's a second verse in the Torah which demands that a child has to revere. Some may translate the word used in the Torah as to fear. It's not fear in the sense of terror, but more be perhaps in awe or to revere and to show the proper respect for a parent. And the Talmud, source number 3, discusses, and Rashi quotes it on that verse, what is reverence? How is one to find reverence? One should not sit in a parent's place, should not speak in the parent's place. If the parent is speaking, the child should not interrupt or speak where the parent is supposed to be speaking. A child should not contradict the parent. That's probably a little bit more challenging oftentimes. What is honor? A child provides food, provides drink, clothing, puts on shoes. Okay, again, this is where it's appropriate. Not every parent wants the child putting on their shoes per se, but in a situation where that's something which is a means of showing honor, accompanies the parent when they come in, accompanies the parent when he or she is leaving. Those are examples of honor. Obviously, it spreads out from there, but these are some of the common examples that Rashi gives us for the two obligations, one to revere a parent and one to honor a parent. So we have these two commandments. On top of that, in source number 4, is a curse in the Torah. Accursed is the one who degrades his father or mother. Okay? So speaking badly of a parent, and we'll see, as we move along, we'll try to see if there are situations where one may speak badly of a parent if it's necessary under certain circumstances. But in general, to speak badly of a parent, if it's not for a constructive purpose, is not just problematic, but there is a biblical curse attached to one who speaks badly about a parent. Okay? It's important to note that there are two major ideas behind the obligation to honor and to revere a parent. The Sefer HaChinuch, which is the book written where he counts all the 613 commandments in the Torah, when he discusses it, he says that one of the ideas, and every mitzvah has many ideas behind it, some which we are aware of, some which we are not, which is why we don't have, one of the major ideas why we don't have a right to start fooling around with the commandments of the Torah on our own volition, just because we may think we have some understanding, but there's much more depth than we can possibly comprehend. But one idea that comes up is the idea of gratitude. A parent has given a child life. Most of the time, as you said in the top of the bell curve, a parent has given much more than just life to a child, has raised the child, has provided for the child. But just the idea of gratitude to a parent is one of the ideas behind that obligation to honor a parent. And by extension, it's also looked at as a paradigm, as you pointed out also in that study, with our relationship with God Himself. When we can relate to to individuals who have given us physical life in this world and provided for us, we can, by extension, have a relationship and express gratitude to our Father in Heaven, who has provided us with life and provided us and takes care of us on a daily basis. Now, having said that, people may come and say, okay, well, my parent really made my life miserable. If a person has an abusive parent, and so on and so forth, where the parent really made the child's life miserable, so what gratitude would I have? So one classic response is, well, the parent gave life, and life is a priceless gift, and therefore one has an obligation of gratitude. One, that could bring up a great deal of discussion. Some people may not feel that way. Some people may feel that they would have rather not lived at all. That's really a separate discussion about the value of life, not for right now. But people may feel that way, whether it's a fair viewpoint or not. And so then you kind of come back to the question of do they have an obligation of gratitude? Even if the child does have an obligation of gratitude, oftentimes the parent did not have the child in mind when they brought the child into the world. Does that nonetheless obligate the child's ingratitude and so on and so forth? So a lot of commentators and sources point out, and they say that in the Torah, God says in one place that honor your father and mother as I have commanded you. And so a number of sources, including Rabbi Shimon Schwab, Rabbi Schwab's grandfather, says that there's a second element we have to focus on over here, and that is God is commanding us to do this, whether it makes sense to us or not. There's a mitzvah in the Torah to honor a parent, even if the child views the parent as a horrible, terrible person and has no sense of gratitude to the parent whatsoever. At the end of the day, the Torah says, God says, I am telling you, you have to honor a parent, whether you connect to it in a fashion of gratitude or not. You have an obligation to honor that parent. So the obligation is there regardless. Which creates, as Ari mentioned, a lot of sticky situations. Because oftentimes, and again, depending if you say on big T and little T drama, and I'll try to get to that as we move along, we'll just try to see some of the framework of where those questions would fit in. But oftentimes, it creates very difficult situations. Certainly when you have extremely traumatic situations where a child was severely abused in some way, shape, or form, where the child can't even stand the sight of the parent, and you know that's a trigger just being in the presence of the parent. How is the child supposed to honor a parent? I'll make it even more complex. There are sources that say that a child is obligated not just to honor a parent in deed, but in thought as well. A child has to, in a sense, some authorities take it as far as to say that there has to be an element of hero worship by a child towards a parent. What if the parent is not the perfect parent? Okay, if you're not our perfect parent over here, so let's say if you're more like me and you're not the perfect parent, so then how can you expect from a child to have that hero worship relationship? How is one supposed to do that? This is a question that is raised, and even in a fairly healthy parent-child relationship, that can be challenging. Certainly where it's a dysfunctional relationship, that's even more challenging. How would a child relate to that? How could a child even begin to fulfill that kind of an obligation? Let's see a few of the other issues over here, and then we'll try to see some solutions or approaches from a halachic Torah standpoint, then we'll try to see how that melds together with, from a professional standpoint. So, Source number five tells us that if one sees his father, or a parent for that matter, transgressing Torah law, the child should not tell the parent, you have transgressed Torah law, meaning in a rebuking, demeaning fashion. Rather, the child should say, father, isn't it written in the Torah such and such, as if asking him, not warning him, and the parent will understand on his own and not be embarrassed. In other words, you have to, this is not necessarily in today's day and age the best way to do it, but the point is that if a child has a comment to make to the parent, it has to be done in as respectful a manner as possible. This is a good idea in general, by the way, to anybody, but a parent, it's an obligation to do it in as respectful a fashion as possible, so as not to make the parent feel embarrassed, feel shamed. That's an obligation. Okay, so if, let's just say a parent is screaming at a child, and it's not warranted. That never happens to me, of course, but let's just say a parent is screaming at a child or something along those lines, and the child feels, you know, the screaming is not warranted. Can the child say in a strong, assertive voice, you're wrong, you can't talk to me that way, is that okay? Based on this, it would seem like the child has to figure out a nice way to say it. Saying it nicely is not necessarily going to get you out of the situation. So what is one supposed to do? I'm just making the mess as big as I can before we start to see some of the approaches we can deal with over here. Take it a step further. Source number six. If the son is wearing fancy clothing, sitting at the head of a community, and the father or mother come and tear his clothes and hit him on the head and spit in his face, the child cannot shame them but must keep quiet. Okay, so let's just say you're the FBI director and you're giving a talk, and suddenly on the TV screen behind you, your parent comes on and says, you're fired, in front of the whole crowd. Let's just say that were to happen somehow. Would the child be allowed to react to that in any way, shape, or form? Would the child be allowed to go give testimony on the parent in front of Congress or anything like that? Now there's actually a story in the Talmud, which is based on a Roman nobleman, some of you may have heard of him, by the name of Dama, the son of Nesina, who was a Roman nobleman and was sitting in a gathering of the Roman nobles, and the Talmud takes him as the paradigm, as an example of a child who honored his parents and respected his parents, that the mother had a mental, emotional illness. And she walked in the middle of this gathering, and he's sitting up there on the dais, and she starts screaming at him and spitting at him and tearing his clothes and telling him how he's a worthless, good for nothing. And he just sat there and did not react. Again, is that expected from any child in any situation to just sit there stone-faced and not react in the slightest and allow oneself to be traumatized and abused in that fashion? So, Let's try to see a little bit what the limitations are, or what the allowances are, and how we can make it practical, and then try to make it as practical as possible as we try to bring it all together. Source number seven starts to give us some of the allowances or limitations of the obligation. The Talmud discusses the following case: what happens if a father tells a child who is a Kohen? Now, a Kohen of the priestly class is not allowed to become impure through contact with a corpse, generally, except for an immediate relative, a parent, a spouse, or a sibling, or a child, God forbid. But otherwise, a Kohen is not allowed to walk into a cemetery where there are graves, come into contact with a corpse. What happens if a father told the child, who's a Kohen, I want you to go ahead and come into contact with that corpse? Or, that lost object, I don't want you to return it. It is a commandment, an obligation in the Torah, to return a lost object. So how do you know that the son should not comply? Perhaps the obligation to honor a parent, respect the parent, supersedes those obligations. So the Torah tells us, every man, your father and your mother, shall you revere, and my Shabbos you shall guard, I am Hashem your God. And the Talmud is bothered by the juxtaposition of all these statements. Where does Shabbos, the Sabbath day, come into a discussion with honoring a parent? And why does the verse conclude, I am Hashem your God? I did mention earlier one approach to that, that it's a commandment whether you like it or not. But the Talmud says that God is making a point. I am on top of all of you. Okay? And just like you must respect the parent, but your parent and you both have an obligation to listen to me, says God. And therefore, if a parent tells a child to transgress a Torah obligation, positive or negative, the child not only need not listen, should not listen, and must obey God first. And so if the parent tells the child to transgress the Torah law, the child should not do that. Now, this would have ramifications in situations where perhaps the parent-child relationship could lead a child to break Torah law. And we'll see more about this later. Because Torah law, although the examples given in the Talmud are returning a lost object, coming into contact with a corpse, perhaps transgressing the Sabbath day, but there are a lot of many more subtle kinds of commandments where a parent may command a child. Just one very basic example which is brought up. Let's say a parent has a fight with a certain individual, okay, and really makes an enemy, doesn't like a certain person. And the parent tells the child, I don't want you to have anything to do with this fellow. He's a jerk. He embarrassed me. He's a terrible person. I forbid you to talk to him. Okay? There's a commandment in the Torah that you're not supposed to hate someone. And there's a commandment in the Torah, love thy neighbor like yourself. Now, if you get into a fight with someone, you have to work that through and figure out how those commandments work. And maybe that's another Torah for Tycoon's class. But for our purposes, the child really has no fight with this person. Just the father is commanding the child to do so. So the child need not necessarily follow the parent's orders to avoid and to despise the person because it's contrary to a mitzvah in the Torah. Okay? Another law, another limitation, which is very important to our discussion. Source number 8. This that a child is required to provide food and drink. We mentioned earlier that one of the modes of honoring a parent is to provide food and drink. Who's paying for that? Who's footing the bill? The child? They might run you out. Might run you out of the money quickly. What?
So
I'm sorry. Let me just finish the statement over here. You'll find. Sorry. A child provides the food and drink. It is from the money of the father or the mother. So the child need not pay money to honor the parent. He must give of his time, as the law continues. But one must honor a parent with his body, meaning to give of his own time. Even though through this he'll be unable to work and will need to go begging, but only if the son has food for the day. Now, this last line over here is a complicated law. Let's just say that the parent says, "I want to go." Mom calls and says, "Let's go out to lunch today." Okay, mom, but you're paying for the bill. No problem. So you go out for lunch on Monday. Then mom calls on Tuesday and says, "I want to go out for lunch again today." And if this goes on for a week, you're going to be out of a job pretty quickly. Okay, now mom may be footing the bill, and you may be getting a free lunch, but there ain't no free lunch. And you're going to have a hard time working. So, exactly where you draw the line on this is a somewhat complex issue. But suffice it to say that if the child will not be able to function and make a living to provide for himself and his family, he need not spend all of his time honoring the parent. Okay, and so therefore the authorities say that if it will cost the child a job because he's spending so much time with the parent, the child need not engage in that kind of activity. Okay, so in a general sense, the child need not give up his own money. Now we'll see later that this idea of giving him his own money is not limited to money. It applies to other things as well, such as emotional well-being, which is a very, very important point for our discussion over here. The child need not necessarily give up his emotional well-being. So that kind of brings us to source number 9. Source number 9 is a somewhat lengthy source, and it's a very, very important source. And this is a discussion by one of the medieval Torah authorities known as the Maharik. His name was Rabbi Yosef Cologne. And he says the following. He was asked the following question. A person wanted to marry a particular woman, and the parents objected to the marriage. Now, let me just add some of the sordid details around this question. This woman was something of a scandal, because this woman was previously married, and there was talk that there was stuff going on before she got divorced, I believe, with this individual who was asking the question. It was not confirmed, nothing was known, and therefore, normally if a married woman commits adultery with another man, they are forbidden to each other, even if she subsequently gets divorced. But if it's not known as a fact, if it's just talk, generally it would not halachically forbid them to wed, unless there are hard facts that are known. But the parents obviously were not too happy about this match, because it was a scandalous match. And the question was, does a child have to obey the parent? That's the question. Even though it would apparently bring shame upon the parents, it was a scandalous kind of situation. He says three things. He says, number one, it seems to me that if this woman is proper for him, meaning he sees this as what we call his basheret, this is the woman whom he would like to marry and whom he'd like to spend his life with and whom he can have a successful marriage. The father has no power to protest against the son. First, in regards to financial outlay, like the one who says it from the father, meaning we rule practically that the parent has to provide the money, not the child. Certainly here in a matter that causes physical distress to leave the woman he desires and have to marry a different woman, okay, or perhaps not marry anyone at all, that is what he's calling physical distress or what you might call emotional distress. So he puts that in the same category as financial outlay. The same way a child will not have to pull money out of his pocket to honor or respect the parent, the child need not destroy his emotional well-being because of the parent's demand. That's point number one. Point number two, furthermore, it is close in my eyes to commanding a child to transgress a Torah law. For our sages have said that it's forbidden to marry a woman until one sees her. Meaning, don't do a blind marriage. A blind date, perhaps, but a blind marriage, don't trust the person who's online. And there's an obligation. This is basically an obligation for the prospective couple to meet and make sure they are compatible and this is a good idea. Okay, how many times they should meet, how long, and so on and so forth. That's a very, very complicated question we're not going to get involved in. As someone was just telling me before the class, you know, within the Orthodox community, they have their approach. In the world at large, they have their approach. Even within the Orthodox communities, there are different approaches. That's not our subject today. But there's an obligation, at the very least, to meet and make sure you are compatible with each other. And that, the reason the Talmud says for that is, you have an obligation to love your fellow. And if a person is going to go ahead and marry someone without ever having met them, that's a recipe for disaster. And it will certainly make it very difficult to fulfill that commandment if one has not done due diligence before choosing a spouse. Okay? And so he says that if the son is not going to be allowed to marry the woman whom he wants, but whom the parent wants him to marry, then that's not going to create a healthy marriage. And so it's akin to not meeting the spouse. The point of meeting the would-be spouse beforehand is to make sure it's a good match. And if the son feels he's found a good match and his father says, no, I don't want you married, go marry, find someone else, he's going to end up in a marriage which is not going to work and you run into the same problem. So he's effectively asking the child to transgress Torah law. The child is not obligated to do that. The last reason he gives, and this is an absolutely fascinating reason, and there's much discussion around this last reason, in a matter that is not directly related to the father, such as here, it is obvious that the father hasn't the power to protest against the son, neither due to honor nor due to reverence. What he's saying is, whom the son marries does not directly affect the father. It's an indirect. If someone in the family goes off and does something scandalous, it may be embarrassing, may be shameful. If a child goes and marries someone who the parent doesn't approve of, it may be painful, even if it's not embarrassing publicly, it may be painful to the parent, but it is not directly affiliated with the physical well-being of the parent. And so what the Ma'arik is saying over here is that the obligation to obey a parent, to respect a parent, is when it relates directly to the physical needs of the parent. Provide them with food. Provide them with clothes. Don't sit in his place. These are directly connected to the parent. If it's less directly related, the classic case is, mom says, don't forget to put on a sweater before you go outside. Mom, it's 80 degrees. Now you're going to catch a cold. Okay? Do you have to put on the sweater? Based on this, many would say, you don't. Because at the end of the day, mom is not going to get sick because you're not wearing a sweater. If mom says, I need you to bring me my sweater, because I'm going to catch a cold, you may well be obligated to do that. Okay, but if she wants you to put on the sweater, you may not have to. Listen, according to this last reason. Now, this last reason is a subject of much discussion because the Ma'arik over here is giving all three reasons together. And the question is, are they sufficient as standalone reasons? Or is he kind of putting them all together and betwixt all three, you have reason why the child can ignore the parent's demand when it comes to the marriage? Okay, and so practically speaking, regarding the last idea, it's not an allowance that is often used except under very extenuating circumstances with close consultation with a very competent halachic authority who is aware of the laws as well as the ins and outs of a particular situation. Okay, and I'm sure you can think of many cases, you know, where a parent is making unreasonable demands of a child, not even directly related to their physical well-being. You know, would the child have to listen, and so on? So you can imagine from these three sources that now we really have a wealth of reasons where we can make allowances or limitations to the parent-child relationship and the obligation of the child to the parent, where there would be limitations. Emotional well-being. I mean, he says it right there, and that is used as a standalone reason. If honoring the parent or respecting the parent is going to be is going to have a deleterious effect on the emotional well-being of the child, then the child is absolved from the obligation. Okay. Now, as Ari pointed out, and you can comment on this, sometimes it can be worked through, and the child can move himself to a place where he can determine the nature of the relationship and get himself to a place where he's able to relate to the parent in such a way where he can have a relationship with the parent, and it's not emotionally traumatic. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes the child cannot go back to that situation and be emotionally abused, so perhaps forgive the parent, but not necessarily be able to go back and get hurt again, then the child will be absolved. If the child, though, can, let's just say, go for some sort of therapy and work through the issues and figure out a way where he or she is able to have a relationship with the parent that will not be harmful to the emotional well-being, then the child may well have an obligation to take those steps to try to make that happen, if it's possible. So then the child has the ability to fulfill the commandment of honoring a parent, of respecting a parent, within certain guidelines and boundaries, but if the opportunity is there, if it can be done, then the child may well have an obligation to go ahead and try to make that happen. If it's not feasible, it's not feasible. But if it is feasible, then the child, you know, again, every case is, it's a case-by-case basis. There's no one-size-fits-all, and, right, it would be, so if a case like that would come up, it would be best for the child to go consult with a competent halachic authority, and you would need, I guess you would say, a team of a professional, such as we have over here, and a halachic authority working together to figure out, I guess, a plan of action of how this can be resolved and dealt with. Okay, and these kinds of issues come up all the time. So that really, in a sense, is the overarching framework of how a child ought to be dealing with a difficult parent. Difficult, whether it's a big T trauma, whether it's a small T trauma. That really, in a sense, creates the basic framework. Number one, the child is not obligated to sacrifice emotional well-being. And the second point is that a child does not have to transgress Torah law. So if the parent is making unreasonable demands that will compromise the child's ability to keep Torah law, if the parent, another example which would come up, let's say the parent wants to move into the house of the couple. Okay, and it's not easy having the parent in the house. You have an elderly parent who is perhaps at an advanced age and is being difficult and is a parent of, let's just say, the husband, and the wife is not prepared to have her mother-in-law move in at an advanced age into the home. Must the husband honor his mother by moving in at the expense of his spouse? Okay, and again, case-by-case basis, it needs consultation, it needs working through. But there's an idea over here. The idea is that the Torah mandates that a husband is obligated to provide a wife for her physical and emotional well-being. Having a mother-in-law in the house is not going to provide the wife with physical and emotional well-being, then he may well not only be absolved, but not allowed to let her into the house. It's a mitzvah in the Torah, it's an obligation. The husband has an obligation to provide for his wife's physical and emotional well-being, and if bringing his mother into the house is going to not allow that to happen, then essentially the mother is telling the child, I want you to transgress Torah law. He can't do it. Now again, sometimes it's workable, sometimes it's not, and it's a case-by-case basis how to deal with it. But you have this allowance, I don't know if I'll call it a loophole, but a wiggle room, that the Torah law is not blind to the realities of life. The Torah, on the contrary, the Torah law is working with the realities and the challenges of daily life to ensure that the relationship is able to continue. Which brings us to source number 11. 10 was doubled up, I apologize, it's there twice, I already touched on that, but source number 11. I mentioned earlier that there's an idea of accursed is the one who degrades a father and mother. So, having said that, you have, people talk about their parents all the time, especially teenagers are very, very good at this. They will have conversations all day about how clueless and nerdy and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera their parents are. Most of us probably have these conversations either in our minds or verbally at some point in our lives. And our children will probably have these conversations at some point in their lives. And, okay, that's how the world goes. But let's look at it from a halachic standpoint. From a halachic standpoint, is it ever permitted to do that? Technically, a child has no business doing that. On the contrary, there's a curse associated with that. But let's say a child has been abused, needs to go to a therapist and talk it through. Well, there's a curse associated with that. So there's a passage in the work Chafetz Chaim, written by the Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, who he says the following idea in regards to the laws of Lashon Hara. You are not allowed to speak negatively about someone else. Let's say you need to get something off your chest. You need to speak it through with someone else, how someone insulted you, abused you, etc., etc., and you need to get it off your chest. So he says that if intent in telling the Lashon Hara is to alleviate one's anxiety, it is regarded as for a purpose for the future. Meaning, there is an allowance within the laws of Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is defined as speaking in a negative sense. If saying something is not negative but is for a constructive purpose, just as an example, someone comes over to you and says, would you like to go into business, invest $50,000 with me, and a guy over here in the conversation knows that the guy making the proposal is a swindler and a crook, he is not only supposed to, but is obligated to inform the would-be investor that this guy is a swindler and a crook. He's obligated to do so. Okay, again, it has to be done properly with the proper guidance of what should or should not be said to alert the person. Okay, that's purposeful, it's constructive. And the Chafetz Chaim says that speaking something through to get it off your chest, if you need to vent, or you need to work it through, or with a therapist, or whatever it may be, that is also constructive. Okay? And so there are authorities, halachic authorities, who say the same applies to a child who has issues with a parent, whether the issues are real or imagined. But if there's a need for the child to talk it through, and it's being done for a constructive purpose, then that would be fine. Again, having what they call a bull session with your friends in the pizza shop, everyone sharing their tales of what idiots their parents are, probably doesn't fit that bill most of the time. Okay? But, yes, please, go ahead.
Just a moment. I heard this thing, I think my wife told me about this, that some study was done that let's say that we speak at 100 words a minute, our brains speak at 1,000 words per minute. And so if you can imagine, I don't know if you ever had this, but like, you know, the ongoing, you know, this idea and that idea and this voice and that voice, what it does, can do is really generate a lot of energy and a lot of pressure, so that by the time, you know, the situation that we're thinking about or obsessing about comes up, we're kind of a wreck. So, along the same vein, that this is not only to alleviate one's anxiety, but to improve your function in a situation, especially when it comes to parents and the stress that can generate. So how much more valuable that is, have a session with your therapist before you move into your parents.
Yes. So, like you said, perhaps you could, you know better, but if perhaps a good friend perhaps serves that purpose as well.
Certainly.
Right? So
therapist. Certainly.
Yeah.
We know from Pirkei Avos that it says, Selech HaRav, make for yourself a rav, a teacher, or a master, and buy yourself a friend. I believe it's Rabbeinu Yonah who says that because having a friend that you can have that kind of relationship with, and having that one friend who you can really, you know, bounce ideas off of, and have somebody who can, you know, can reflect back to you in a genuine way, is so valuable, it's worth paying for.
Yes, and so a good friend, if a friend serves that purpose as being someone whom you are able to speak things through with, then will be permissible. But, you know, all the friends sitting around probably generally is not the ideal way to go about that. Now, just a couple more points over here, and then I am, as usual, short on time over here, but just a couple more important points. Source number 12, I kind of alluded to, if a person's father or mother has, God forbid, lost his or her mind for whatever reason, one endeavors to deal with them in accordance with their wishes until heaven has mercy upon the parent, meaning hopefully cures the parent. But if it's impossible for the child to stand and deal with it, the child may leave them and appoint others to deal with them properly. Okay, again, if a child cannot deal with the parent, because the parent is difficult. Either there's an emotional illness, or for whatever any other reason, the parent is just difficult in general, then the child has a right to leave the parent, and if the parent needs care, the child doesn't have to see to it that the parent is taken care of. But the child often, especially because the laws of honoring and respecting a parent are pretty strict, so for a child to take care of a difficult parent can be very, very difficult in trying to keep the laws, and very often it's better for the child to appoint someone else to care for the parent. If the parent doesn't need care, just the parent's difficult, and so the child just doesn't want to be around the parent because the child just can't deal with it, so then oftentimes the ruling will be that it's permitted for the child to just stay away as much as possible. And even the parent says, you never visit, you never call, I'm busy, and so on and so forth. If the child can't do it, and it's too difficult, then there may again be leeway for the child to stay away from the parent. Till now, we're talking about difficult parents, perhaps abusive parents. There's one more issue that comes up over here, and that is the question of what if the parent is defined by halacha as being a rasha, a wicked person. What if a parent is a gangster, is a mobster, is a murderer, is a bank robber, and just it's very difficult for the child to relate to the parent and to have any respect, not because the parent was abusive to the child, the parent was a bad person. Okay, so there is actually a dispute between the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama as to whether one must nonetheless honor the parent or not. The Shulchan Aruch by Yosef Kairo, who is generally the decisor for Sephardic jury, says one must nonetheless honor or respect the parent. How one does that, if I have a minute, I'll try to talk about that. I do apologize, I'm running late for a change. The Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who is usually the decisor for Ashkenazic jury, goes with the opinion that until the parent repents, the child is not obligated. Now, how you define wicked, generally the parent has to be deliberately, knowingly transgressing Torah law. It has to basically be actions of wickedness. If the parent doesn't know any better, that wouldn't necessarily define them as wicked. We're talking about the parent knows better, was brought up in an environment that allows the parent to do better than that, and nonetheless is doing bad things, as defined by Torah law, that would render the parent as wicked. Again, there are always, as you pointed out, everyone's coming from somewhere. It's not always the parent's fault, and so the parent may not be defined as wicked just because the parent does terrible things. It's not always their responsibility, and so again, it will be a case-by-case basis. But that may absolve a child altogether of the entire obligation. Okay? And just the final source number 16, source number 15, I'm going to skip over this, we're short on time. Source number 16 is kind of just a cherry on the top of this whole discussion. And that is, one who wishes to truly honor his father and his mother should engage in Torah and good deeds, for this is the greatest honor for parents. That people say, fortunate are the father and mother who raise a child such as this. In other words, there's an idea of honoring a parent by you being a good, upstanding, productive Jewish individual who is a fine, upstanding member of society and who brings what we call in Jewish terminology, bring nachas. I don't know how to translate that word into English. If anyone has a good word for that, you let me know. Bring nachas, joy to the parent that they have a child like this. And that is generally true across the board. Even if the parent disagrees with the child's, perhaps spouse or lifestyle and so on. But most parents, if the child is productive, is achieving in life, is a good person, then most parents will nonetheless derive nachas from their child, even if they weren't necessarily thrilled with some of their choices in life. Okay? And so that is always something that most people can do regardless of whether they have a relationship with the parent from near or afar. Okay? So that is, like I said, it's a complex subject and it's a case-by-case basis, really how to best deal with it, but just a framework of where the Torah gives us the flexibility to be able to honor a parent in difficult circumstances. I hope I gave over some of the ideas over here that would complement Ari's presentation. I know it's late, but are there any questions? Stunned silence. Oh, okay. That would depend if the parent is defined as a wicked person. Not everyone in prison is wicked, per se. Huh?
Bernie
Madoff. Ready? Okay. We won't have to decide first if he's indeed a Russian. I mean, one could make the argument he stole a lot of money. You would have to examine all the sides. If halacha would define him as a Russia, and the last name makes me believe he is of Ashkenazic descent, so then the last name does, he made off with a lot of money, right? So if he would, you know, then theoretically the child, if you want to define him as that, he would not have an obligation. If the parent repented, then he's no longer wicked. He may not have paid everything back. And how you define repentance, especially when it comes to financial areas, is complex. If attempts are being made to get the money back and so on. But that may, you know, if the parent has repented his past deeds, that may well, you know, so very often people in prison are penitent for their past deeds. So then the child may well be obligated to visit the parent, even if the parent did terrible things.
I think source 15, the one who skipped, brings that out.
Okay, well, source, you're right. Source 15, which I skipped over, I always get in trouble for skipping anything. If the parent's not wicked but has bad character traits and is despised by people, or is a drunkard, then it's a good idea for the child to distance himself from the parent. But again, it would depend on the situation, but you're right. And sometimes the parent's in prison and the parent did something relatively minor and can end up in prison for that, or did something which perhaps, I don't want this to come out the wrong way, but let's just say a parent committed a white-collar crime, which everyone does, and just this guy got nailed, or something like that, was made an example of, so is the person despised, et cetera, et cetera? No. They may have made one, you know, a mistake, ended up in prison, just because the parent's in prison won't necessarily absolve the child. So it really depends on the situation, but yes. Yeah.
Is there any provision in Torah law that compels a parent to be kind to their children?
Yes.
What?
There's an obligation in Torah to be kind to people. In fact, there are many sources that say that what obligates a parent to raise the child? So there is a rabbinic obligation, what we call chinuch, training the child. But from a biblical standpoint, it's an obligation of chesed, of doing kindness. Okay, if you'll indulge me in a quick story. Someone once came to the Brisker of Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, and he said he had a conversation with his uncle, who was not terribly observant, and this fellow was of the more Haredi type. He had a large family and so on, and the uncle was kind of mocking him and saying, you have this large family and you spend all your time with your children and paying for them and caring for them, and what are you going to, you know, why are you doing this? What do you have from it? And he told the Brisker of, well, what I have from it is that when I grow older, my children will care for me. And he went to the Brisker Rebbe, he wanted to know if his answer was the appropriate response, and he told him, this individual, the Brisker Rebbe, was known for his fairly sharp replies, and he said, the words he used, I don't know how literally he meant it, he said, that's almost a heretical statement. But he said, the reason why you care for your children is because God said you have to be kind to others, and charity begins at home. The very first people you have to take care of, these are verses in the Torah, you shall not ignore your own flesh and blood and so on, you have to take care of your children. So there's an obligation of kindness, even if you're not getting anything back from it at all. And sometimes there are children who are in that state, you know, whether by their choice or otherwise. But there's a mitzvah on the parent to do what he or she can to care for the child. Again, sometimes it's emotionally stressful and traumatic, and then it's not so simple. But yeah, there is an obligation to care for the child.
Can I also propose that if we were to come to our parents and say that you have an obligation to be nice to me and respect me, that probably may not go over very well. In fact, a friend of mine once went to my rabbi, Rabbi Noach Orlowick, and told him that he was having struggles with his father-in-law. And Rabbi Orlowick said, with regard to trying to change your father-in-law, you have a much better chance of success if you were to go to Shaar Shechem, which is the Arab quarter in the old city of Jerusalem, jump on a car and yell, kill Arafat, and wave around a gun. You're more likely to succeed doing that than trying to change your father-in-law. I would propose the same thing in trying to change, frankly, anybody, but especially our parents.
Okay, thank you all for coming.